1052 DR Oshkosh.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. It's 3 days from the New Hampshire primary where Donald Trump will try to move closer to another Republican presidential nomination. ABC's Mary Alice Parks in Manchester says Trump's main rival in the state, his former U.N. ambassador, Nikki Haley.
Trump overnight saying this about Haley.
She is not presidential timber. Now, when I say that, that probably means that she's not going to be chosen as a vice president.
The fact is, this primary will likely be decided by independents like Dennis Kutcher, who make up 40% of New Hampshire voters.
I think Nikki is the right person who should hopefully be able to bridge the divide.
Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina endorsed Trump last night. Bitter and dangerous cold in the forecast for tens of millions of people in the U.S. The weather's been blamed for at least 55 deaths. And President Biden told America's mayors that significant changes are needed at the southern border. This is ABC News. President Biden spoke Friday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The White House says they discussed efforts to secure the release of hostages still being held by Hamas. Some lawmakers have raised questions about further support for Netanyahu. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said,
"The Israeli people get to decide who represents them, who their elected officials are. We don't decide that. And we will always work with whoever the Israeli people decide to put in into power and government."
Florida's MacDill Air Force Base confirmed the discovery of a historic cemetery on the property.
In 2019, the Tampa Bay History Center notified MacDill officials of a possible African-American cemetery at the base. Over 2 years, the base conducted a non-intrusive archaeological survey, says Lieutenant Laura Anderson.
We had ground-penetrating radar out here searching the area. We had cadaver dogs.
They say they found over 100 probable or possible graves and are still investigating. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Brian Clark, ABC News.
The Todd Allbutt Show.
Matt Flynn, thanks for joining us. As an attorney who's been in a lot of courtrooms, Trump may insist on giving part of his closing oral arguments on this case. I'm not sure if you ever saw the ABC series Boston Legal with William Shatner as Denny Crane. We're approaching Denny Crane territory here.
It's flat out crazy. It's like taking out your own appendix with a Bowie knife and you have no anesthesia. You don't know what the hell you're doing.
The Todd Allbutt Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Todd Allbutt Show.
Luke Mathers, it's time for Tuesday Tangents with Lukester.
Everybody announced yesterday, schools are closed tomorrow. I feel like a boomer almost here, Todd. Where I'm like, back in my day, we never got a snow day in advance. I remember sitting patiently, like cross-legged in front of the television set, just waiting for the little ticker to scroll by. And if you missed it alphabetically, you had to sit there even longer.
The Todd Allbutt Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Divorce court judges in Wisconsin have a lot of leeway when it comes to setting alimony payments. Advocates are working for a more fair and consistent formula. Here's more from Mike Moe.
Without that predictability, some people might not be getting a fair shake. Custody Exchange, an online firm that helps families navigate divorce, is out with a new analysis of alimony laws across the country. The company Shea Dress says only about a third have a formula on the books. The remaining states, including Wisconsin, essentially give judges discretion to sign off on an amount without a guideline. Settlement agreements often take shape beforehand, but Dress says that's not always the case.
If you can't reach an agreement, because many people who are divorcing aren't on super great terms, and they go to a judge and they say, okay, you decide, what should the alimony amount be? And if that's you going in, you have no idea what to expect.
Dress says this can be especially problematic for those who can't afford an attorney to guide them through negotiations. The authors recommend implementing policies in states where there are none and for ongoing assessments of existing formulas. Dress says in cases where someone isn't able to secure fair terms, whether that's the person receiving the payments or the other half responsible for them, it can have a lasting effect.
Having bad alimony arrangements can have impact on each of the ex-spouses, on their children, and it can have ripple effects.
That might include housing instability or other forms of financial hardships. Indrow says while existing guidelines can help a judge make a decision, there's still flexibility to consider traditional factors such as income levels for both spouses, their ages, and the length of the marriage. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-teens. Clear tonight, round zero, partly sunny, 17 for Sunday. It will be breezy out of the southwest. For Monday, mostly cloudy, a high near 30 degrees. And into the mid-30s for Tuesday and Wednesday. Chance of rain or snow Tuesday night. Currently, one above.
Your home for Mino and the Mayor in the morning. Weekdays from 6 till 8. Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM WISS.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, January 20th, 2024, and my name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this hour and next hour as well on this, our weekly Saturday morning review, our analysis, and our discussion with you of some of those most significant and impactful news events, developments in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. I am honored and I am delighted that you've selected to join me and my wonderful producers, Anya and Johnny, again this morning for this all-important discussion of things that are significant in our lives, important to our localities, our state, our nation, and our world. This is our 81st broadcast on the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin. We're coming to you this morning from the WAUK radio station in beautiful downtown Waukesha, but delighted once again to invite to our discussion this morning listeners, callers, folks who are interested in our subject matter from all across the state. And as always, you can do that very simply by sending to me, to Anya, to Johnny, your questions, your inquiries, and yes, even your comments on some of our syllabus items. Call us at 844-967-2789. That phone number once again, 844-967-2789. Or you can also go online. Go online to Civic Media. Find your particular broadcast station. Find the folder that says Morning Cannoli and write to us. Send us an electronic inquiry, a question, a comment, and we will include that in our all-important discussion this morning. Now, as always, this morning, January 20th of 2024, we ask three principal key questions. We ask what happened. We focus a lot here on what we know. What are the facts, whatever those may be? Second, why are those kinds of things important? Why are we talking about those things on our Saturday morning broadcast? Why are they relevant? Why are they material to your understanding of the world in which we all live together? Why are they significant? And finally, in many instances, what should we do about those things? Not how we should think about them. We don't dictate that in America. We do have a First Amendment that enables all of us to express our views in ways that are consistent with our reasonable and rational perspectives on things. But we do, in fact, identify the ways in which we can respond thoughtfully, meaningfully, purposefully to those things that are happening in our world. And so we also ask those questions about what should we do in response to the things that have happened, why are they important, and what actions, responses, reactions, and answers should we pursue in response to those things that are happening in our world. Our syllabus today comes to you exactly one year before we inaugurate another president. Almost certainly, not for absolute certainty, but almost certainly, we're going to be inaugurating one year from today an individual who has previously served in the capacity as our chief executive under the Constitution of the United States of America. It looks right now, not for certain, but looks right now as if the candidates for the presidency in this calendar year 2024 were all going to the polls in Wisconsin four different times, but especially in November of this year, two candidates likely before you, the voters, to be elected to the presidency of the United States of America, either Joseph Biden, the present incumbent of that all-important position, or Donald Trump, the previous incumbent of that high position in our elected office in the federal government. So we will be thoughtfully focusing on a lot of that today as we pursue what is, as always, our ambitious but our achievable agenda this morning, involving you again with questions and inquiries that you may have, hopefully along the way, informative and maybe even inspiring as you pursue your lives today and throughout the coming week and month and year. What is that syllabus this morning all about? We're going to be spending some time on what I regard as two of the key news stories of just this past week. One of them has to do with this major announcement from the Attorney General of the United States of America about the results of a long, months-long investigation conducted by the United States Department of Justice into the horrific shooting at Uvalde, Texas. I'm going to talk about what happened there way back on May 24th of 2022. And significantly, we're going to talk about the findings coming out of a special focused inquiry pursued by the Department of Justice into that horrific shooting, taking the lives of many people in that school, and also compromising the safety and security of the community generally. Lessons learned, a scathing report from the U.S. Department of Justice, and in particular the COPS office there, which we'll talk about more, providing some information not only about what happened, but about the ways that things went wrong in Uvalde, both in terms of responding to the horrific shooting that was going on, but also in the aftermath of that. We're going to talk about that and analyze some of the lessons learned so we can think about the role, once again, of the rule of law in our nation, the pursuit of justice, and what government is involved, the United States government, involved in these kinds of things to address the recent events in our nation's history. Second, we're going to spend some time talking about a major Supreme Court case that was decided, actually going to be decided in June of this coming year, but was argued this past Wednesday before the nine justices of the Supreme Court. A case that's going to affect the way in which our federal agencies work in the future. We have talked a lot about this major case in past broadcasts here, called Relentless or Loberbright Enterprises versus Raimondo. Raimondo is the way that I have been referring to this case. We're going to chat about why this oral argument was not only so important this past Wednesday, but we're going to try to read the tea leaves coming out of that oral argument, give you some sense about what the Supreme Court may in fact do in June of this coming year as it resolves an all-important issue about the relationship between federal courts and the deference that is properly given to our federal agencies, the experts, the people who know what they're doing, know what they're talking about inside those agency environments, a case involving a Chevron doctrine, C-H-E-V-R-O-N. I'm going to talk a lot about that this morning. And then since we're going to be chatting about the Supreme Court, also looking at other things that happened in our high court just this past week, the brief filed by Donald Trump, one of the candidates for the presidency, arguing that he should, in fact, be on the ballot in Colorado. That brief now filed with the U.S. Supreme Court, anticipating a prompt decision by that court after there's more briefing and perhaps even oral argument coming up sometime soon. We're going to talk about also a significant thing that happened in Maine of this past week, again, involving a court there that put on hold the decision to keep Donald Trump off the ballot in the state of Maine. I'm going to talk also a little bit more about some other January 6th related matters. I'm going to talk about one of the January 6th defendants from time to time on this broadcast. We review one of the sentencings that has been undertaken by a federal district court judge in the District of Columbia, imposing sentence on one of the many, many thousands of people who were involved in the attack on the Capitol, now numbering about 1,200 people convicted, charged by the U.S. Department of Justice for involvement in that. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about something coming out of the New Mexico. The attorney general are making a decision about a fake elector prosecution, the possibility of that, and the decision that he made not to pursue that. The reason why that's important for all of us, including right here in the state of Wisconsin, when we think about that fake elector issue that we have likewise discussed a lot on this particular broadcast. Then, in connection with other matters on our docket this morning, also going to chat about the continuing litigation in a New York federal court. This is the defamation case brought by writer E. Jean Carroll against the former president, Donald Trump. I'm going to talk about what happened in the courtroom just this past week, a trial that continues on Monday of this week, presumably headed toward a jury decision sometime soon on the second portion of defamation claims brought by E. Jean Carroll based upon what the former president said when he was in the presidency, when he was our chief executive, coming out of the Oval Office. What did he say at that time that prompted this particular lawsuit? How does it relate to the previous lawsuits? And what can we expect coming out of the federal district court there in Manhattan with respect to these charges brought, civil charges brought by E. Jean Carroll against Donald Trump? Then we're also going to talk about some other cases around the country. We're going to go to Texas. We're going to go to the state of Texas to talk in particular about a decision made there by the governor and the legislature, which we have previously discussed. And the response, once again, by the U.S. Department of Justice, what in the area of immigration enforcement, as we've talked a lot on this broadcast, under our Constitution, immigration, one of those fairly few issues in the experience of Americans that is exclusively delegated for policy development, administration, law enforcement oversight to what? To the federal government, not to the states, for a variety of very good reasons. Our founding fathers said when it comes to immigration issues and matters related to border security, those things need to be in the hands of a national federal government as opposed to a state government. I want to talk again about what Governor Greg Abbott did a number of weeks ago, signing legislation that empowers state authorities to begin to enforce the environment, the immigration laws there in the state of Texas. And the response, once again, by the U.S. Department of Justice just this past week, bringing a lawsuit to challenge the passage by the Texas legislature, the signature on that legislature by the legislation by the governor to require the enforcement by state authorities of immigration issues. I'm going to chat about all of that on our very, very chocked full of significant information, news, insight, all in the area of rule of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. And as always, we're taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789 or go into the Civic Media app, find your particular broadcast station, send Anya, send Johnny, send me a comment, a question, an inquiry about one or more of these topics as we launch into them right now. I promised before that we would begin our broadcast with a discussion of what happened in Uvalde, Texas. And yes, that's indeed where we're going to begin our discussion this morning. We're going to spend some time right after this first break telling you again what happened way back in May of 2022, and then reviewing this very significant, huge report issued by the Department of Justice, extremely critical of law enforcement. We'll tell you more about what that all means and why it's important to you here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Stay with us for that discussion.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
Governor Evers lays out his priorities for 2024 when he delivers his State of the State address. I'm News Director Terry Bell. Join Civic Media's Todd Albaugh and me as we bring you the governor's speech live, right here, Tuesday night at 7, followed by the Republican response. Todd and I will help you understand what it means for you, your family, and your community. Join us for the governor's State of the State Address, Tuesday night at 7 here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999 and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Grave Digger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW and on the Civic Media app.
Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
Yeah, and on the Civic Media app.
This is the Shaw, WAU.
We are back this morning. Thank you once again for joining me on our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about all things law and justice and the aspiration for justice in America. Beginning with our discussion this morning of this major report, a major report issued by the Attorney General and the U.S. Department of Justice in the wake of the horrific shooting in Uvalde, Texas, way back in May of 2022, a finding of unimaginable failure. That's the description in this report. In the police response to the shooting in Uvalde way back in May of 2022, an unimaginable failure of law enforcement to respond as it should. How do we get there? How do we get that result based upon what the Department of Justice has found? Let's go back and recall what happened on that day. Recall that a lot of reporting about this, but again, confirmed in this hundreds-page report issued just on Thursday of this past week. A lot of information about law enforcement focusing on it, but also describing along the way what happened on that day. Significant signs that the Uvalde killer, and not described by name, not identified by name in this report, but he was plainly a troubled and a bullied loner. He was nicknamed actually the school shooter by some acquaintances even before the shooting itself happened. Dropped out of high school. He used money apparently from his fast food jobs to buy an arsenal of two, yes, that's right, semi-automatic weapons. How many times have we heard that? He also used conversion devices used to increase the rates of fire, all those kinds of things that have been the subject of what? Of legislation, proposed legislation, state and federal, to stop this horrific problem that we have with semi-automatic and automatic weapons in America, and also purchased thousands of rounds of ammunition. In the days leading up to the shooting, he made menacing remarks to co-workers at the fast food job that he was working at. He talked openly about being suicidally depressed, and all of this, once again, in the report that anticipated the findings by the Department of Justice with respect to law enforcement. At 11:10 a.m. on May 24th, 2022, he shot his grandmother in the face. And then he texted a 15-year-old girl in Germany with whom he was engaged in some conversation online that he planned to shoot up an elementary school. And sure enough, he drove his pickup truck to the nearby school there. He dipped in a ditch. He entered the school building through an unlocked door. You recall all this information from the reporting at the time, and began firing indiscriminately at young students who were gathered in a pair of connected classrooms there. Now, this is where it becomes very significant. The reason for bringing all this back to your attention is because this is the focus of the review of the actions of law enforcement. What happened next? Law enforcement officers arrived fairly quickly, almost immediately on the scene, and approach those classrooms. Again, according to this report issued by the Attorney General, the shooter fired at them, and they retreated down an adjacent hallway. Then, and here's the key, for more than an hour or so, local, state, and federal officials, including agents from the U.S. Border Patrol, discussed how to deal with that situation. And they made the fateful, again, now condemned decision to classify this incident, what had been happening up to that point already, as a barricaded standoff that required negotiation rather than an active shooter scenario. And as we know, in the wake of many other shootings, including Columbine from way back when, that classification as an active shooter situation, that scenario would have, should have compelled law enforcement to engage in an immediate and aggressive response. You go in. The lessons from recent years, as horrific as they are, horrific that we should have lessons from these kinds of mass shootings, but nonetheless is that law enforcement confronting active shooter situations, you go in. That has been the training. That has been the rule. That has been the law enforcement practice in every place. In every place that has confronted this up to now, apparently not in Uvalde. Justice Department officials initially said that their investigation, which was led by this thing called the Community-Oriented Policing Office, the COPS office that I made a reference to before, would take a long time to complete. And indeed, it did. Several months, just under 2 years, actually, to complete. And what is it? What is it specifically in the wake of all of that that the Attorney General announced just on Thursday of this past year? Here it is. Here it is. A near total breakdown in policing protocols that hindered this response to this horrific shooting that I've just described in Uvalde, Texas. 21 people dead. The refusal, the report says, to rapidly confront the killer needlessly cost lives, and the Department of Justice confirms that in its report, and the Attorney General says as much as well in his comments in Uvalde, along with other representatives of the U.S. Department of Justice, including the Associate Attorney General. Her name, of course, responsible for the oversight of this is Vanita Gupta. Ms. Gupta, a wonderful, like the Attorney General, a wonderful public servant. I had the great privilege of working with her when I was at the Department of Justice, not only as a U.S. attorney, but also prior to that time. Vanita Gupta is also a part of this community. She has come to Wisconsin. She came to Oak Creek and was a part of the remembrance of the shooting at Oak Creek, and delighted, even in the midst of that great sorrow, to have her presence. She repeated that this past week, along with the Attorney General, as the two of them appeared in Uvalde, met with the families in advance of their public announcements, and then made some public announcements about exactly what this report said, described this event as a cascading failure of leadership, decision-making, tactics, policy, and training, all of that based upon this delayed and passive law enforcement response that allowed this 18-year-old gunman with this semi-automatic weapon to remain inside this pair of connected fourth-grade classrooms that I described before, the place Robb Elementary School. That went on for 77 minutes before he was confronted and killed. The most significant failure, this investigation concluded, was this decision by local police officers to classify the incident as a barricaded standoff. This as a part of the findings of this report, rather than classifying as an active shooter situation, which, again, what is the result of doing that? Identifying that and saying, we need to respond quickly. We need to go in. This is not a situation where we wait, where we can negotiate. And that's apparently exactly what the Uvalde law enforcement authorities did at the time, requiring instead instant and aggressive action. Not done at the time. Significantly, almost all of the officials in charge of that fateful decision that day have already either been fired or they have retired from public service. So what did Attorney General Merrick Garland, speaking to the residents of Uvalde, speaking to the families, say about all this? He said the officers who converged on the school within minutes of the attack intended to storm the classroom. That was their intent, but were told to stand down. And yes, indeed, the Attorney General went on to say this, not only in response to media inquiries, but also as a part of the reporting that Vanita Gupta and he did just this past week. He said this. He says lives would have been saved and people would have survived if officers had acted quickly to confront that government. He related a timeline of some critical moments when officers were outside the classrooms that could have halted the rampage, and they did not take action. The main takeaway from this report, the investigation, we're going to talk more about that right after this break, and then draw some conclusions from this. Why is this important? Why is this a rule of law issue? And what happens next, not only in Uvalde, but around our nation? Stay with us for that continuing discussion.
your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM WISS.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. It's 3 days from the New Hampshire primary where Donald Trump will try to move closer to another Republican presidential nomination. ABC's Mary Alice Parks in Manchester says Trump's main rival in the state is former UN ambassador Nikki Haley.
Trump overnight saying this about Haley.
She is not presidential timber. Now, when I say that, that probably means that she's not going to be chosen as a vice president.
The fact is, this primary will likely be decided by independents like Dennis Kutcher, who make up 40% of New Hampshire voters.
I think Nikki is the right person who should hopefully be able to bridge the divide.
Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina endorsed Trump last night. Bitter and dangerous cold in the forecast for tens of millions of people in the U.S. The weather's been blamed for at least 55 deaths. And President Biden told America's mayors that significant changes are needed at the southern border. This is ABC News.
It's the Packers and the 49ers at Levi's Stadium. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The winner of this game goes on to the NFC Championship, one step away from the Super Bowl. The Packers played a near-perfect game last week against the Cowboys. Can they be any better? Head coach Matt LaFleur.
We're going to need a better game for sure. Absolutely. I think you can always get better, right? That's our mindset. There's always something that you can improve upon. We're going against a great opponent, and we're going to need to be at our best.
As the one seed, the 49ers had last weekend off. How impressed were they by this young Packers team? Linebacker Fred Warner.
I mean, they got our attention no matter what, honestly. You went in on the road as a seventh seed against a really good Dallas team. I mean, that's enough in itself. And then the fact that they won the way that they did. The thing that was really impressive was the way that they were able to run the football. You know, Aaron Jones has been playing at a super high level. I've respected his game for a long time. We got that mutual respect there. So that's going to be obviously another point of emphasis for us.
That's 49ers linebacker Fred Warner. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-teens. Clear tonight, round zero, partly sunny, 17 for Sunday. It will be breezy out of the southwest. For Monday, mostly cloudy, a high near 30 degrees. And into the mid-30s for Tuesday and Wednesday. Chance of rain or snow Tuesday night.
Currently, one above.
Valentine's Day is here. This year, give the ultimate gift. Name a star after your sweetheart. This is Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. For 45 years, we've named millions of stars for celebrities, dignitaries, and individuals worldwide. For $59 and a call to 800-282-3333 or visit starregistry.com, you can give the most memorable gift. The star you name will be recorded in book form in the U.S. Copyright Office. Visit starregistry.com or call 800-282-3333.
Jackson Hewitt has a plan to get your tax refund fast. With a buck, buck here, buck, buck there. Here, buck, there, buck, everywhere, buck, buck.
You don't have to wait weeks for your tax refund. Get money sooner with a no-fee refund advance loan at Jackson Hewitt.
On this loan, there's a money today guarantee. E-I-E-I-D-O.
Don't settle for chicken feed. Get fast bucks at Jackson Hewitt today. No-fee refund advance loans by Republic Bank offered to eligible clients. Money today guarantee if approved for a loan on a prepaid card. Details at JacksonHewitt.com.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You told me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
From the home of the largest fly-in in the world, we are Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
We are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast talking once again about this major report issued by the U.S. Department of Justice this past week, reviewing the horrific shooting and even more compelling for our present understanding, as horrific, as significant as the loss of life there in Uvalde was and remains, important to understand what happened with law enforcement and to learn to try to remedy these problems in the future. The Department of Justice issuing this report, giving some instruction about what should have happened and what can, in fact, be done in the future to remedy these situations so the horrific losses suffered by communities like Uvalde don't happen again. So the main takeaway, again, as Merrick Garland said just this past week, that officers who respond to an active shooting scene need to, as he said, immediately enter the room to stop the shooter with whatever weapons and tools the officers have with them. Whatever weapons, you do not, in fact, wait. And that's one of the big takeaways from this report. It is not simply telling the community what happened. We have seen already in the media the stories, the reporting, the compelling comments made by members of the families of people lost and injured in the course of this horrific shooting, talking about their perspectives on this and saying, you know what, as significant it is that the Department of Justice does this, what we need to ensure is that in the future there are lessons learned, or lessons not only revisited but reaffirmed for law enforcement. And that's exactly one of the reasons why we're talking about it here on this Saturday morning broadcast. Along the way, of course, it's important to identify those particular people who may have been involved in not responding as they should. Initially, blame for the delayed police confrontation shifted, if you will. In the immediate aftermath, there was some focus upon the state police chief. His name is Stephen McGraw. And after that, the local police chief, Pete Arredondo, was also implicated, if you will, in failing to address in a thoughtful and purposeful way this horrific event as it played out. Turned out afterwards, as the report goes on to confirm, that state police officers were also among those who failed to actively confront the gunman. A lot of responsibility described in this report. And focusing once again on the decision by Pete Arredondo and others to delay going in. A 600-page report compiled from 260 interviews, 14,000 documents, videos, probably the most comprehensive assessment to date of a killing spree that helped spur the passage of some new federal gun control legislation. We know about that from the actions by our chief executive and, yes, by the Congress. Not enough, plainly. And this report also continuing to underscore the need for the Congress and our legislatures around our country, including right here in the state of Wisconsin, to address the automatic, semi-automatic weapon problem that we do, in fact, have. The reality of this was perhaps best summarized by Vinita Gupta, who said, again, the Associate Attorney General responsible for the Civil Rights Division, its special litigation section inside the Civil Rights Division, inside the U.S. Department of Justice. She said this was an unimaginable failure. The delay, she said, in confronting the gunman meant that the 19 children and two teachers who were fatally shot did not receive immediate medical care. One teacher and at least one student were found seriously wounded, but alive in the classrooms, later died. While being transported to hospital, 17 others were injured, and they, in fact, survived. That question about what could have happened, again, addressed in many ways by the Attorney General and by Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta just this past Thursday. Now, what do we take away from this? Well, in addition to identifying the people who made these horrific decisions or non-decisions to go in, reaffirming what we'll call the Columbine rule, which is when you have an active shooter, law enforcement obliged with, as the Attorney General said, with whatever tools you have, you go in, you do not wait. This is not a negotiation situation. Reaffirming that fundamental principle that we have known since 1999. A lot of focus here upon failure to train, failure to report, failure to properly understand what one does in these situations. So the Department of Justice offering some very detailed recommendations, not only to you, the Uvalde law enforcement, Texas law enforcement, frankly, law enforcement throughout the nation once again, learning from what happened to that community, the families who lost people in that shooting. Those recommendations, including adherence to guidelines, these fundamental post-Columbine guidelines that call for neutralizing a gunman immediately in any situation where this active shooter situation is present and identified. So the officers have to be prepared to respond in a situation, even to risk their own lives, the protection of their communities. And that's the other big takeaway, which we've talked a lot about on this broadcast, the concept that public service is not easy. Public service, especially law enforcement, is not an easy thing to do. But it's also a critical part of our general commitment to the safety and security. And those people who deserve our respect and our admiration for taking on these jobs also carry with it a tremendous responsibility on our behalf to act in ways that are responsible. It is this dual commission to not only adopt and embrace the service feature that they provide, but also to do it with competence and to do it consistent with understood policies and practices. Officers, the Department of Justice said, have to be prepared under these circumstances based upon that dual commission to risk their lives for the protection of the people they serve, the communities like Uvalde in which they are operating. Even if they have inadequate firepower and are armed only with some standard issue handguns, to confront a gunman with a much more powerful weapon. The report put some blame on state officials who said it had also shown no urgency about setting up an effective command structure at the scene of the shooting. And as I said, also a huge amount of focus upon failures to properly train, failures to properly understand what to do, and even to put together the kinds of things that we should anticipate in these critical incidents. Now, this report, once again, coming out of the Department of Justice, called a critical incident review inside the Civil Rights Division, initiated about 20 months ago by the request of the mayor there. And significantly, again, what happens in the wake of this? Well, the Attorney General said that the report itself is in many ways the significant response to this horrific shooting, but more has to happen. And while the Department of Justice role in providing this kind of interactive and, if you will, invasive instruction that now needs to take place in any law enforcement situation that is not properly trained, not properly armed with the things that needs to do, both in terms of operational styles and mechanisms, but also equipment. Department of Justice has mechanisms for doing that, and plenty will follow up based upon the findings of this report. The other question, of course, is what about some more responsibility for those people who failed, as this report indicated, failed to live up to that commitment to service that I just talked about? Well, the local district attorney, her name is Christina Mitchell, has been conducting an investigation to determine whether any state criminal charges should be brought. And when the Attorney General and the Associate Attorney General, Vinita Gupta, met on Wednesday with the families, some of them specifically asked, of course, that that kind of criminal prosecution be pursued. We will anticipate further reporting, plainly from the DA there, as she continues to investigate this matter and follows up on it. Again, the important rule of law takeaways, the importance of police in our society to ensure our safety and security, and along with that, the requirement and the expectation, the legitimate expectation that all of us as citizens of our nation, of our state, and of our localities have. It is not too much to say, even though, yes, indeed, public service, law enforcement is not easy, still, coming with that great responsibility is the obligation to do it in a way that is not only competent, but is up to date in terms of policy and practice, training, and ensuring that when these things happen, as they will regrettably continue to do in America, that our law enforcement is ready to go. A significant report for all of us to understand. It is 600 pages long. It is a lot to consume, but very important in the life of our nation. A significant report coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice this past week from the pen of the Attorney General, from the pen of the Associate Attorney General, from the COPS office, telling us all about who we are and about, yes, the importance of living in a nation where our government can, in fact, admit and identify errors. That is something that, even in the midst of this horrific situation, the need, the compelling need to remedy what happened in Uvalde, that is also an important rule of law takeaway that we do, in fact, identify and talk about our errors so that we can correct them and make certain that in the future, to the best we can, they do not happen again. Uvalde, Texas, an unimaginable failure, according to the Department of Justice, this past week. Let's talk about the other big story coming out, this time of Washington, D.C. That story, of course, coming out of Uvalde, Texas, but out of a Department of Justice entity again, the Cops Office, the Civil Rights Division, located at Main Justice in Washington, D.C. Right down the street, right down Pennsylvania Avenue on Capitol Hill is what? I suspect that many, if not all of you, have visited there in Washington, D.C., is the site since 1935 of our U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in our land. We know some things about the Supreme Court. We talk a lot about it on this show. I'm going to spend some time this morning in the remaining moments of this hour and next talking about a major Supreme Court case that was argued before the nine justices just this past Wednesday. Before we do that, let's talk about where the Supreme Court is today. Right now, 4 months into the 2023-2024 term, a term, as you know, that begins on the first Monday in October and finishes on September 30th of the following year, even though most of the major decisions are going to start being issued in March, April, and especially May and June of every year. That's when we anticipate the big cases being issued. And indeed, the case we're going to be talking about in principal focus this morning, this Raimondo case, also known as the Relentless case, actually two cases brought together for consideration by the Supreme Court just this past week, a part of 57 cases to this morning, 57 cases in which the Supreme Court has already said, we will take a look at these, we will review them. We have talked about a lot of those. Why? Because they fall in this category of guns. A lot of focus, Supreme Court cases pending right now about various aspects of the firearms issue in America. A lot of cases involving social media and the interaction, once again, between social media providers and our government. And a great number of cases involving Donald Trump. And we'll chat a little bit about some of those as well, including a major brief that the Trump attorneys filed with the Supreme Court just this past week. But then also, we have spent a lot of time talking about these agency cases among the 57 that the Supreme Court has already indicated it will take and it will review, anticipating that in the end, the Supreme Court will probably decide somewhere between 60 and maybe even 70 cases. In recent years, it's been about 62 or so. Not too long ago, it's been in the 70s or so. So maybe adding about another 10, maybe 15 cases yet to its docket. In that connection, two of them from the Seventh Circuit, one of them involving something called the Armed Career Criminal Act, a sentencing issue to be decided, and then a second criminal case also coming out of our own Seventh Circuit, which again is Wisconsin and Indiana, Illinois. Those are the three states, those three states that have district courts together combined to make a circuit court. From the Seventh Circuit, these two cases, one involving the Armed Career Criminal Act, the other involving something called gratuities payments, also a criminal case and interpreting a section of the Federal Criminal Code. Those two among the 57 already on the docket of the Supreme Court. Just to give you some sense of where these cases are otherwise coming from, highest number coming from the Fifth Circuit. Those are the states principally directly in the south of us, along the south border. Second Circuit has seven cases. That's basically New York and other states in that area. The Ninth Circuit has eight cases pending. And yes, indeed, under the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, five cases coming out of states and district courts as well. When we come back, we'll tell you about another one of the oral arguments among the 20 that have already been conducted on some of those cases as we continue our Saturday morning discussion of the United States Supreme Court and things before it. Stay with us for that second hour of our discussion this morning on our Saturday morning broadcast.
This is Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
Hi, I'm Pete Schwabe, an actor, writer, director, and comedian. Join me for my new show, Nightlight, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll chill after a long day in traffic, talking politics, or trying to look busy at work. We'll talk movies, TV, theater, music, and lots of fun Wisconsin stuff. So mix an old-fashioned and join the discussion. We'll go from Wisconsin to Hollywood and back, and you can still be in bed by 10. It's Nightlight with Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 8 to 10, on Oshkosh Air Support, 98.3 FM, WISS.
I was proud to be a soldier.
I told the truth and got kicked out.
And so I thought to myself, I'm taking this rule down.
If you're an LGBTQ plus veteran, your memories are important too. Share your story with the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, where firsthand accounts from U.S. military veterans are preserved and made accessible for researchers and future generations. Visit loc.gov/vets to submit your stories, photographs, and documents today.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
I'm Terry Barr.
The Shaw, WAUK.
I'm Terry.
And we are back for our continuing discussion this morning of all things related to justice, the delivery of justice, the administration of justice, rule of law, and government in America. Thank you for your continuing involvement in our discussion this morning. As always, taking your phone calls at 844-967, or you can drop a comment into the Civic Media website. Go online and send us your inquiry, your question as well. And Anya and Johnny and I will be delighted to entertain those inquiries from you. Talking now once again about the United States Supreme Court. And among the 20 oral arguments it conducted in 2023, the 9 so far in 2024, among those 29 altogether that our United States Supreme Court has conducted so far, one of just this past week. As an important footnote, 11 more are scheduled in February, and 16 cases among that 57 yet to be scheduled, including a major case involving the interpretation of the very statute under which the former president, Donald Trump, has been indicted, at least in part. Whether the charges under that particular statute are legitimate, not addressing so much the specific indictment against him. Another case called Fisher, in which the defendant raises the issue of legitimacy of using a particular federal statute to charge as it was against him. Also charged in the same way against the president. We'll talk more about that Fisher case down the road as well. But this morning, I want to spend some time talking about a civil case pending in front of the United States Department of Justice, having to do with what we've chatted about before, this thing called the Chevron Doctrine. The Chevron Doctrine, C-H-E-V-R-O-N, comes from a case called Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council. 1984 is the time that this decision was made. It is one of the most often cited, invoked cases in American law, and that's what makes this pendency of this case before the Supreme Court all the more important, significant, as I have indicated before, as important as those cases in all the other areas are, including guns and social media and certainly the Trump matters as well, and a myriad of other criminal and civil matters pending before the Supreme Court. I would offer that this particular case, or these two cases combined, if you will, are among, if not at the top of the list, most important cases pending in the Supreme Court this term because of the way that this Chevron doctrine and the possibility of getting rid of it after 40 years of precedent could impact the way in which you interact with federal agencies, that I interact with federal agencies, that we understand the relationship between federal agencies and the courts, and what experts, the people who know, the people who understand how these matters work inside their areas of expertise, how those things are best administered in our government. Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council established this principle in 1984. It said basically this: the judges, federal judges, are obliged to defer, and that's where the deference word comes from, defer to agencies' reasonable and rational interpretations, again, based upon expertise, based upon the fact that they know what they're talking about, of interpretations of statutes that may in fact be incomplete and may in fact be ambiguous. You may say, well, gee, how do you get there? Well, we know that Congress, when it is fully active, does indeed pass legislation. And plainly, legislation is not intended to provide for every single circumstance. That's why you've got a legislative branch that puts those broad principles in place. And you have an executive branch that does what? It executes the law and says this is the way in which we are going to apply the law under our system of a three-part government. The executive branch responsible for identifying people, principally in the civil area, who are experts, who know what they're talking about, developing that expertise in all sorts of areas of labor and commerce and agriculture, of space travel, if you will, of education, of law enforcement, of education, of diplomacy, all kinds of things out there that are important to the administration of our government. And the Chevron doctrine says that when it comes to interpreting statutes that may not have clear direction to the agencies, even the federal courts, about how a particular statute be interpreted in a particular case, the notion is deference. The judges are, if not completely obliged, there is an assumption that they will defer and rely upon the good expertise of people who know what they're talking about. In close cases, and there are some, there are more than a few out there, the views of the agency in the end will take priority. Even if courts might have ruled differently, that's where the deference comes from. That's the reason why this Chevron doctrine is so important. Supporters of the doctrine, of course, say that it allows these specialized agencies to appropriately fill in gaps, right? Those areas where the statutes may, in fact, be ambiguous, maybe incomplete, so that the operation of government can, in fact, continue. And they also maintain, I think appropriately, that by doing that practice, that is filling in those gaps, if you will, that's exactly what is contemplated by Congress. Congress establishes, once again, these broad principles and guidelines. The agencies, with their expertise, are the ones who administer it in the specific details of cases before them. Now, opponents to that concept, including very clearly some business groups that have traditionally been hostile to Chevron deference, identify this as sort of overregulation. And they say that the role of courts is, in fact, to rein in some of these agencies. That, again, as we have seen in the present campaigns, this notion of this administrative, sometimes even called a deep administrative state. I assure you it doesn't exist, but nonetheless, that's the language that is used to describe these attacks upon the agencies. And those who are opposed to the Chevron doctrine and want to see it overturned and gotten rid of, they say that's not the executive branch officials, but it is people in the courts who should have free rein to decide these kinds of things. And indeed, it should not be. It should not be civil servants who are responsible, even though they may know what they're talking about with their expertise. They're not the ones who should be making these kinds of things. Others should decide that. They say the agency's interpretations can change with every new administration. Yes, that is true. And that they sometimes put a thumb, if you will, on the scale in favor of government in close cases, even when it is a party to the case. And indeed, Neil Gorsuch has said very, very famously in the past, and once again, just this past week, he says it seems that whenever this particular statute, this notion is involved to apply to statutes, that is Chevron deference, the government always wins. When we come back, we're going to talk more about these cases, again, identified as Raimondo and Relentless, why they're so important, and what the other justices of the Supreme Court said, reading the tea leaves on whether or not Chevron deference continues into 2024 and beyond. Stay with us for the second hour of our discussion.
Broadcasting from the Civic Media Studios on South Main Street, this is Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm Dr. Jasmine Zapata, Chief Medical Officer for Community Health at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Every year in the U.S., about 21,000 lung cancer deaths are caused by radon, an odorless, tasteless, and colorless gas. One in 10 Wisconsin homes has high levels of radon. Does yours? Call 1-888-LOW-RADON or visit lowradon.org to learn more. Test. Fix. Save a life.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252DR Oshkosh, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian.